Welcome to a Modern Nonprofit Podcast, powered by the Charity CFO, your compass for creative solutions in running your nonprofit. I'm Tasha Anderson, your host and guide through this nonprofit maze. From fundraising to volunteer management, we've got your back. Join us each episode for fresh, game-changing strategies that can make a real impact. Hey, welcome back to another episode of a Modern Nonprofit Podcast. I'm Tasha Anderson, and today I am here with another financial person. Yay, we don't get a lot of those sometimes on this conversation. So Maya Tusing, you are the partner and co-founder of Fairlight Advisors, and you all specialize in the investing for nonprofits. We're going to talk a little bit about endowments and what to do with maybe some of that excess cash and how your board should be participating in that. So Maya, thank you for joining us and sharing your words of wisdom on these sometimes, like complex topics that when we talk about numbers and investing, people's eyes immediately glaze over. So hopefully we'll keep this digestible for most people that are listening. But first, before we dive in to kind of the more, complex conversations around investing, let's talk a little bit about who is involved typically when you work with a nonprofit. Who's typically involved with these sorts of conversations? Typically, I'm imagining the treasurer, or who are you typically working with?
Right. So ideally, when we are brought in, it's a nonprofit that has either over time has amassed a large cash balance in their checking account. Often, maybe they put it in a savings account. Maybe they put it in a CD.
Right.
And sometimes it often is like director of finance, and ideally someone from the board who's the finance chair. And that individual usually has some sort of financial knowledge.
Sure.
If they are an accountant, that's great. But often it's someone who has a facility for financial statements, really wants to get their head around the cash needs and the funding of the organization. We do like to see someone in the operator's leadership. So member, whether it's an executive director or director of finance, with partnering with someone on the board, because it is really one of the greatest partnerships that you can have, because as you know, you want the board to be aware of this, and as well as have staff who's usually going to be the point person on the day to day. So that's usually what we like to see. It doesn't always come that way. Usually it's a staff member who kind of does is the point person for the rest of the board. But I think that collaboration is ideal.
So I'm sure in your experience, you've worked with tons of different treasurers or, finance chairs and things like that. I'm curious, and maybe you've served in some capacity in that way too, for other organizations. I certainly have I certainly have as well, I should say. And what I find interesting is this spectrum of level of involvement or, we'll leave it at that, for what a finance chair or a treasurer does. And you mentioned one thing, like typically for those organizations that have gotten savvy enough and have accumulated a big, balance in their bank account, they want to do some sort of investments. That's typically a treasurer or finance chair that steps in. But what other kind of roles or responsibilities have you experienced or have you seen with the treasurer? And I ask this because I get this a lot from our clients. I see some treasurers that are super involved, maybe too involved. I get some clients where, what treasurer? We don't even know who that is. There's such a spectrum of level of involvement. And I'd love to just hear from you, from somebody that works with so many. What's kind of your take on that?
Yeah. So let's step back with kind of the finance chair and the finance committee. And that group, or if it's small enough, it may just be one person, is supposed to keep a pulse on all things financial regarding the nonprofit, and they're able to translate that performance to the broader board in collaboration with the director of finance or CFO of the organization. And in collaboration is the operative word here.
Right.
because they have to have the common mission to ensure mm-hmm. the financial resilience of the organization. Mm-hmm. And this is not just financial statements. Often you probably seen a treasurer might say, well, you know, I check, they send me the financial statements before the board meeting, looks good. You know, it's far more than that. It's mm-hmm. everything that affects financial performance, whether that's mm-hmm. liquidity or cash levels, cash health. Mm-hmm. Do they have any endowments? It's really surprising when so many times we will ask, is this it? Well, actually, we have another bank, you know, or mm-hmm. actually, we have this brokerage account where mm-hmm. we have $1 million. You know, it's mm-hmm. amazing that there are pots, just like people, there are pots of money everywhere. And I believe the finance chair should just keep peeling the onion to find mm-hmm. out where is all the money, because you may have more resources available than you think. And I found that often, mm-hmm. you know, over time, they'll open another bank because they see a good CD rate, or someone says, you know, I really like this bank. Maybe they'll get us a donation. Mm-hmm. So we'll put a few thousand. Right. Uh-huh. Really understanding all those sources of health. But then other indicators of health, donor pipeline health mm-hmm. and diversification of donors, operating mm-hmm. health, staffing health. And while the finance chair isn't directly responsible for those leading indicators, there are other kind of subcommittee chairs who might, they should be asking those deeper questions, because they eventually are going to hit, as you know, terms like leading and lagging indicators. The financial statements are lagging. It's too late.
Right.
You want to know what's going to happen and be able to predict some of these trends that happen.
Exactly. I love how you were referencing that the treasurer, or which is typically, by the way, like the finance chair, right, for most organizations. And mm-hmm. in some organizations, I think you bring up a good distinction. Some organizations, the larger they get, they typically have a separate finance chair. I'm sorry, finance committee. And sometimes those committees are often board members, but sometimes they're not. They could be committee members that don't quite serve on the board. And then sometimes really small organizations, their treasurer by default is typically their finance committee. But what I'm seeing is that the most effective treasurers are those that, like you said, could speak to the financial performance and the financial health of the organization. And I will tell you, so many times I've sat in board meetings or on presentations or in front of donors even, where no board member could, including the treasurer, could speak to how the organization is doing financially. And I think a sign of a really good treasurer is somebody, like you said, that can take the financial report provided by whoever's doing the books in-house and present that in an intelligent way to the rest of the board. They would feel comfortable enough speaking to the key elements of what's happening within the organization without having to have that finance in-house person right next to them fielding most of the questions. And that's oftentimes what I've seen. And so if you all are out there listening and your treasurer is like, well, that's not my treasurer, think about how you can get there, because that really mm-hmm. means, to your point, Maya, that the treasurer is asking the right questions and informed enough about what's going on in order to even have those conversations. And if they're not informed, then they're not asking those questions, and it all kind of falls apart.
I agree. I think you're right in that. I think we also have to realize sometimes treasurers, and I've sat as a treasurer many times, when you're, it's probably like you, when you have a financial services background, they immediately put you in treasury. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you should not feel, even if you don't have that kind of background, that you should come in and understand everything. I mean, I can read a financial statement, but if someone just gave it to me, it's a bunch of numbers, even for me. Right. And it takes a while to crunch things. And if I see just, you know, one period, I can't tell if that's better than last year or better than 2 years ago. I can't tell how is this quarter compared to another quarter. And I, you know, I'm also a very visual person, and I know that there will be people on the board who could have a meaningful conversation about the financials if we show it in a different way. And I found often the And this is often a challenge for CFOs or directors of finance. They're busy people. And so they come in to the board meeting. They have 15 minutes and they show the statements and then they leave. And so it's hard for anyone to be able to understand the true health of the organization unless you're, number one, showing things graphically for those who don't look at numbers and say, okay, that's less than this. And what was that last time? And let me go to the board portal and see what the last one said. Or see it over time. And as you said, asking right questions, some people are going to, you know, it may ruffle some feathers and you have to be ready for that. And you also have to be ready to ask kind of what seems like dumb questions. I've said, you know, I don't understand the difference between this fund and this fund. And they're like, oh, I'd be happy to tell you. Maybe the rest of the board does, but I'm new. I don't know how this organization works. So it's okay to ask those questions.
And I think, and I'm excited to dive into the questions because I think it's important for any treasurer out there listening that my understanding, everything I've read and practiced and seen with all of my years working with nonprofits, is that your job is financial, like understanding, right? No, asking those good questions. We'll talk about some of my favorite questions here in a minute. Understanding high level, like compliance, did the audit get done? Did the tax return get done? And being more kind of strategic and high level policies, those sort of things. What you shouldn't be doing is going into the accounting system and changing transaction coding and, you know, just micromanaging the day-to-day operations or doing the day-to-day operations. You've seen some of those treasurers that kind of run it like it's their own personal bank account. It's like, whoa, you're here for oversight and governance, not actually doing the work. And I've seen this especially challenging for organizations that were small at one point and relied on their finance chair or treasurer to substantially do their books. And then evolving to kind of an oversight role. And I've been involved in an organization now where we're kind of in that gray zone where we're trying to mature beyond where the board, you know, is really an oversight role. And the financial skills of the organization is more still evolving. And so
that's interesting you say that. When you talk about evolve, you know, I studied a lot of psychology in college, and so I'm thinking of kind of there's a kind of a psychology mindset that develops. You know, you could have had what was a volunteer organization where you needed board members to get into the weeds, and then as it grows, it may be harder to let go because this person who had that financial role and then they hired someone, they work together and it gets bigger. Or I've seen another where you have the board too involved is there was a serious problem where they had to let an executive director go and maybe a lot of staff. And then all of a sudden the board is running the organization, even a large organization. And they realized how, you know, off the tracks the organization was going. And so it's hard to go back once, let's say they've turned it around. It's hard to go back to that. Well, you know, I need to get under the hood of, you know, turnover or unused vacation, you know, it's just
It's like,
no, that's not cruel anymore. Maybe it was for that short time while things were chaos, but now it's time to pull back the reins, and hire well.
And I think that organizations that I've seen that are in this middle space, on one hand, it's like, board, you are in charge of oversight only, except when we need you here, and here, you know, which is still arguably day to day. And I find this especially interesting as the board, you know, terms end and you're in this kind of middle space where you're bringing on maybe board members that are a little bit more advanced in their board volunteerism. They have more experience serving in a different capacity, but yet the organization is still in this middle space. So it's a very interesting, what does a board treasurer do and what is really their role? It's such a big fuzzy gray area for so many organizations. But I think really the pinnacle is, like we were talking about, high level policies, practices, making sure that the organization is adhering to those compliances and is informed enough and savvy enough with the financials to be able to speak about the financial health of the organization without having that, you know, finance person that serves on the in-house team or whatever that looks like parked right next to them fielding most of the questions. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Most organizations are somewhere on the spectrum.
Yeah.
And you should most feel, are not over here.
Yeah. And you should feel comfortable enough that if things go off, you know, the rails, that you're going to step up and help. And, mm-hmm. You know, I've seen the other way where people were not enough engaged. You had a more engaged chair who started asking some more difficult questions, and then board members flee because right. they're like, wow, I didn't know that this was happening. And I'm kind of embarrassed that on my watch, it didn't happen. And then you have only a few board members who are left holding the bag. And so it's better that you right as you join the board, you start asking a lot of questions and know where those challenges are and realize you're going to be there if it goes, you know, you want to be there when it turns around.
Yeah. Yep. Speaking of like asking questions, what are some of your favorite questions that you think a treasurer, either new or existing, should be asking to kind of those key executive leadership that's actually running the organization, the executive director, the director of development, director of programs, or whoever? What kind of questions do you like to ask just to keep your finger on the pulse?
Yeah, I think I raised one was kind of where are all the banks? What are all our financial? I mean, these are really easy questions. I mean, I think some people think, oh, are there certain ratios that you're looking at? No, really, you know, who's our bank? How much do we have there? And, you know, what is our run rate? You know, how much do we keep there for operations? Do we have any savings account that we shut to the side? Do we have a reserve? How much in reserve? Why? Right. Why do we have that much or not that much? Do we have any brokerage accounts that you can remember? We, you know, of a nonprofit that completely forgot about a brokerage account that they had that still had authorization of board members and staff who are no longer with the organization. Right. And when you say, you know, when you start looking at this and they're like, oh, wow, I've forgotten about that. And that person still can look at the performance. So that's a simple, it's like table stakes.
Yeah.
What is, you know, what did the past look like versus the present? Which is what you think the future is going to look like? You know, let's look at what your expenses were over time and why is it gone up? Have we grown? Is it good expenses or are there some episodic things? And I know we talked a little before the call about COVID. I mean, there was a lot of upheaval there. And so trying to understand what's normal and is that coming back or some of these things just
something
never
different. Right. Yeah. I think all those are fantastic questions, just getting a baseline and some of the little, I kind of put together a list of things for nonprofits that most either funders or board members never ask that I've seen kind of behind the scenes, the board has no idea this is an issue. And some of those are, like you said, digging a little bit deeper, paying attention to those trends. And some of my favorites that it's like, wow, that's a huge mess. And they don't realize, for example, like understanding long-term debt and the maturity of that long-term debt. I had a client one time that brand new executive director, I sat down my very first meeting and the board had told her, oh, your fundraising goal is X. Well, what they didn't mention is, oh, by the way, in addition to the $700,000 or whatever it was that you needed to raise, you also have like a $500,000 note that is ballooning and is going to be payable like this year as well, which, by the way, they don't have cash for. So, you know, $700,000 of, you know, operating need and another $500,000 for, you know, terms. So knowing the debt kind of makeup and the maturity of that, understanding different revenue sources and like, how are those earned? Is it true like philanthropy and they're just grants or trickling in of investment income? I'm sorry, individual contributions or maybe endowments, investment income. But I think a lot of times treasurers don't understand like the complexity of how earned revenue or some of these government contracts work. And are we on track? Are we off track? Because sometimes we look at the budget like, oh, great, we're going to like have a $500,000, you know, of revenue coming in from this contract. But you had mentioned something earlier in terms of like other metrics or other things that you should be asking about. Do we have the people in place to be able to do those services that we will then be reimbursed for? Or is that a recruiting issue that is not going to be solved by the time the contract runs out, right? And even other big ones that I've seen board members don't pay any attention to, noticing like payroll liabilities keep climbing. I had one client I started working with that had a massive payroll tax debt issue that no one knew about.
That's a good question.
And honestly, the executive director, executive director didn't even know about it until I said, why is payroll liability, specifically the tax line item, continuing to climb? When we find out, essentially the assistant director, it's like, well, we didn't have cash for that. I'm like, you didn't think to like mention to anybody that you haven't been paying the IRS.
You know, Tasha, you're kind of former auditor, and something I've seen that some nonprofits will believe, or at least board members, well, we had an audit, so that should have found things. There are a lot of things that an audit are not going to find. It's a very structured thing.
Yes.
And the auditor can only go so far in asking questions, right, whether they're relevant or not. And so an audit is helpful to start another conversation.
Because
I've seen plenty of nonprofits that had a clean audit that almost fell off a cliff, right? You know, soon after.
Yeah.
But the audit wasn't asking those questions that were at issue.
Exactly. And so really, I just encourage treasurers to really look at some of these trends. And I think a lot of times we think about revenues, expenses trending over time, but paying attention to those, what we call like balance sheet accounts or like assets or liabilities. Because another issue that I found with one client, and I don't want to get too much into the accounting speak for the non-accountants that listen, and there are most of them are non-accountants, but their revenue kept growing. Their cash was not growing. And so it's like, what is happening if revenue is growing and cash is not growing? And what was happening is it was listed under accounts receivable. Accounts receivable kept growing and growing and growing and growing. And so the board's like, yes, we're on budget. We're earning money, blah, blah, blah. But then it's like, wait, we're cash poor. Like, we don't have any money to operate. So what is happening here? Come to find out that the invoices were not even being properly prepared and sent off to the funders. So we had delivered the services, we had not properly invoiced, and there was a huge write-off because the window of when we were allowed to invoice had already exhausted. We were owed several hundred thousand dollars that nobody even knew that the finance department at the time was improperly sending the invoices and certainly not following up on them because they were over a year old. And nobody was asking the question, like, why are we on track with revenue, but cash is not? Like, this doesn't seem to match up.
Similar situation where same sort of thing, revenue seemed to be healthy, but the executive director was calling those accounts receivable. They were wishful thinking about grants they had applied for. They had no clue whether they were going to get those or not.
Sure.
And those were not accounts receivable. They had not won these grants. Yeah. Yet the board was convinced, had been convinced that they were healthy. And actually, excuse me, grants had actually started to dwindle. same sort of thing. It's like, is that really accounts receivable? Have you, when do you find, what's the timing? You talked about that. Timing is a huge issue. And you know, making sure that you have enough in reserves to be able to fund things based on the timing you believe when that revenue will hit.
Yeah. And it's tricky, some of these situations, but I think it goes back to like the treasurer really taking the responsibility of analyzing those financial statements pretty seriously. And that doesn't mean, like I said before, getting into the nuts and bolts of everything and, you know, calling the bookkeeper 12 times a day and asking them every question about every transaction and, you know, just being a pest, frankly. And I've seen,
yeah, we don't want to scare people that, you know, you have to give the benefit of the doubt that things, you know, because most people are honest and are doing the best they can and will say when they need help. It's when you've got that gut feeling that something's right now, that something's not right. You do ask questions and collaborate with your chair, and make sure that they're on board with you as well.
Yeah. One area that I've noticed that, you know, treasurers and finance committees, especially, specifically finance committees as a whole, because your treasurer might be, you know, somebody savvy in like one type of accounting or finance, but the collective finance committee hopefully gives kind of a broad spectrum of different types of financial related things, whether it's investing and banking, especially if you do lending and mortgages, that sort of thing. Maybe it's accounting, auditing background, you know, kind of a really robust skill set. But some, hopefully, finance committees have some element of investing in finance. Financial investing is a good way to describe that. And this is really important, I think, for my clients. I've shared some of the doom and gloom stories, but there are a lot of clients that we work with that have accumulated kind of a nice little reserve, probably arguably more than what they need, you know, with some people's opinions. And then they start talking about endowments and having people on your finance committee that can speak to investing and whether it's the right time to talk about endowments or creating some sort of investment policy, even if it's not formally an endowment, but how to be smarter with your money. And this is an area I know, you know, Maya, you work a lot with. So what is the treasurer's responsibility there or the finance committee's responsibility based on your experience?
Yeah. So I am a big proponent of endowments, regardless of the size. I mean, we've written some number of blogs and that, you know, endowments are not just for the big boys and girls, you know, we, I'm on the West Coast. And so we think it's not just for the Stanfords and the Yales and the Harvards, you have billions, so, you know, 40 billion plus. You know, we have clients who have just a few thousand dollars. Now, that said, it's because these boards or a major donor or a donor has decided to prioritize that that funding in perpetuity or for a longer period of time, and good financial and investment strategies, belts and suspenders, are necessary to ensure the longevity of that funding. Now, you talked, Tasha, about having amassed an amount of cash. Maybe it's a large unrestricted gift that has happened a number of times. We have, you know, this trend of very wealthy individuals who are just flying down like angels and writing big checks to small organizations. And I found many are flat-footed and saying, you know, they put it in the bank,
right?
And it sits there sometimes for over a year, years doing nothing. And I'll use a term my daughter said, that's a little sketchy, you know, because you're supposed to be deploying that money. And I see that organizations probably feel like, but where do we want? And I think we were talking earlier, let's prioritize those programs or operations that we need that if it's unrrestricted. Let's say it's a we can have a quasi endowment or a board designated fund where we are, you know, we are wagging the tail. We don't have the tail wagging the dog.
Right, so
some major donor who, upon their wishes, wants to direct the organization in a way that is really not their priority, and ends up their endowment rich but cash poor operation. Yeah. I've seen that number of times.
I've seen that.
So what is great about seeding a small endowment is sometimes it can attract the large donors. So we had a client that had decided that they were in the education space. They decided that they should have an endowment. So they seeded it with a few hundred thousand dollars. They paid for all the policies. They decided where that was going to go to. And then they started marketing and using it with development.
Sure.
They got $1 million check. Once major donors feel like you have your ducks in a row, you have thought of process and policy, I feel I'm throwing or I'm putting good money after good. And so it doesn't have to be large, but it should have the policies, those processes that ensure that, you know, the this lasts beyond the staff and the board that is making those decisions today. And that you've written that down and like, why did we do this? It's like a historical record of why do we have this money and what were we saying we're going to do with it and how much were we going to take out every year? You know, is it the 5% and what were we going to put that 5% and who's going to make the decision about where that goes? The finance chair or treasurer should be involved in those conversations. And you know, it's a fun process because it's just like when you're setting up a retirement account as a family or an individual, you know, like there's, this is my innovation money. Like when my next career, you know, what do I want to tap? How that might be in 10 to 15 years.
Sure.
And I'm going to pull from that on a regular basis. And I'm going to be financially free. Same thing.
How much, Maya, I'm curious, what would you say, or what do you all advise? Like, I think of days of cash, right? Cash is king for me. So for an organization, typically, you know, some of our more savvy organizations will have a bit of an operating reserve policy. You know, we want to have X amount of days on cash on hand. Let's say they've exceeded that. Where do you usually like to see an organization have either a percentage or days on cash or whatever before they start considering more advanced investment strategies? And I say that because I've seen organizations that, and I'm sure you see this, get very nervous about the idea of investing in the market. So they'll put them in CDs and they're sitting on like 200 days of cash. I mean, like a pretty significant amount of money, or even more than that. They're at like 150% operating reserves. I mean, they have more money than they kind of know what to do with at this point, luckily for them, but their board or their finance committee even is just still overly cautious. Where is there like a threshold or kind of like a guiding post that you used?
So I know that when you search the internet for how many, how much should a nonprofit reserve, you'll see this
all over the board,
3 months thing. It's all over the board, but you know, the answer unfortunately is depends. When I see 3 months, I say, okay. But I would like to see usually a little more. I'm a little conservative there, but you know, 4 to 6, I'm thinking is plenty. Now, to your point, this whole depends. I saw one very, let's say it's a national organization that was in the headlines and was, is you very much buffeted by political winds, and they kept a year to 18 months. And to me, I felt like that was, they were going through a lot of risks, and for them, that sounded, you know, fine. I've worked with another organization, had 2 months, and I thought, wow, that is really tight. And they said to me, because over the history, they knew their finances so well, they said, we have never gone beyond 1 month under where we've needed to tap more than 2 months. Never. Right. And I push them to 3 months and they're like, we'll do 3 months. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, that showed the experience and the confidence of that treasurer and that director of finance. We know our finances so well. That's money we can't deploy. And I think of, to your point, when you're amassing too much cash, a nonprofit and even a for-profit, a business, can get lax. So I'll give you an example. So I know of an organization that sold some facilities because it was too expensive. And it was in a high priced market. And they were able to get many millions of dollars for this building. And so that opened the door for a lot of change. And so they hired and they went to a new location and all this. Well, little did they know, they were tapping that it was like $15 million, $1 million to $2 million a year. And so it feels like things are, you know, hunky-dory. But what that's saying is that your fundraising or your grants, operations, your development is not sustaining the organization. You're having to tap this money outside. And so it hides, cash can hide larger issues. And someday, if you keep saying, oh, and I've seen this a lot of times,
yeah,
they have this pot of cash, and then problems happen. They're like, that's okay. We've got that million over here that we don't tap. Let's start using it. And then they become, it's like a drug. You start using it all the time, but you're not fixing over here. And then it gets to that point where the CFO says, or director of finance says, that's going away. We need to fix development.
Exactly.
We've got to move out of this facility. We're paying too much.
Right.
And then there's this scramble. And so definitely looking at what is the cycling, looking at not only the year, what are the ebbs and flows of your expenses, but think of that bad year. What was the worst that you experienced in the last 5 years? And if you don't know, ask those who've been around.
Right.
And then that should be your buffer. So it's revenue, it's operations, it's staffing, it's technology, it's facilities needs. If you have risks in any of those five, that ups the number of months that you have. You may be less on the staff. Maybe you're a shoestring. You're, you know, very small organization. You don't have a lot of staffing. You're more kind of contract. Maybe it's not. Yeah. Big a deal. Maybe you don't need a lot of technology, but if all of these things are kind of, you know, less predictable, more months of cash.
Yeah. And I think for me, kind of a rule of thumb is anything beyond, if you have more than 6 months of cash, you as the treasurer, you really have the responsibility of starting to ask the question, what more can we be doing with this money at our risk tolerance level that could be beneficial? And I'll give kind of example that we were recently working with an organization, similar situation. They've accumulated a bunch of money. It was just sitting in a checking account, not bearing basically any interest at all. We redeployed some of those funds to other higher interest, you know, bank accounts, not even investing in securities or anything risky at all. It's just parked into some rolling CDs and some other things. And we were able to generate like another $50,000, $60,000 a year in just really simple interest, because they don't have so much money that it's like long-term investing. We can put it aside for certainly a rainy day, and we're not going to be tapping it for another 10, 20 years anyway. This is an organization that I would say is in the middle space. Like, they had a little bit over, you know, 4 to 6 months of cash, like you said, but they didn't quite have, you know, a whole year's worth of cash. So they weren't willing to be super risky. And I think to your point is good. every organization is different. Every organization is going to have a different risk tolerance because some organizations have a very volatile funding source. You should probably hold on to some of that cash. Some have a really rock steady like operating model with a diversified revenue stream, and the risk of kind of the bottom falling out is pretty slim. You know, or some organizations have a really robust like facility need, and they might need to hold on to, you know, make sure that, you know, hey, if they need to replace the roof or if they have an elevator go out or something, they, you know, need to be able to replace that. So it's all an individualized situation, but I think a lot of treasurers maybe just don't really pay attention as closely or ask the questions, especially if they don't come from the investing world, right? They just kind of come from the accounting world. It's like, great, we have lots of cash. That's amazing. But I think it's really important for us to be asking what else could we be doing? And I know I could talk about this stuff all day. We're running out of time, but
I think, you know, you had raised the whole point about boards being very afraid of capital markets. And it's funny because most of us are invested in the stock or bond market in some way through our IRAs, our 401ks, 403bs. And so, privately. You know, it's interesting to see boards then saying, well, that would be unethical if we invest
in the stock market. Too risky.
You know, but, you know, I'm a big fan of capital markets. I've worked in this for decades and it works. Now, to your point, you know, you're not investing in the stock market if you need that money next year. But, and you're not investing in a CD if you're sitting on that money for 10 years, 5 years. And there, a lawyer friend of mine has said there's a landmark case about a nonprofit that kept money in a checking account and Secretary of State sued them. So it shows that can actually be seen as imprudent as well, as being too conservative.
Right.
Because just keeping it in a CD, especially in the days of really low interest rates, really is not serving your community well. Today, 5% for 3-month treasuries will be fine, and it's been great. And so a lot of nonprofits are buying treasuries or exchange traded funds that invest in treasuries. They're making a lot of cash, and that's great, but that's not going to be forever. And so if you have a longer time horizon that you want to show your organization, we're here for the long haul. We're here longer than I am. So donors, think of us, because we have thought about the next generation of beneficiaries or the community. Yeah. And we need your dollars today that will serve us tomorrow.
And
you know, CDs, money markets, that's today money. That's not tomorrow money.
That's right. And you know, I know there's probably lots of people out there listening, wanting to know, like, yes, this has been a nagging thing on my to-do list. I know I need to get this done. You help organizations. I mean, I think you had shared, you know, you're not necessarily exclusively working with the largest like higher ed institutions. You're working with everyday organizations, you know, even less than, you know, 1 to 20 million and everywhere in between, probably some smaller, some larger. Yeah. I know that people that are listening are probably thinking, I know that this endowment sounds scary, but I'm hearing maybe it's not as big or scary as it needs to be. And I know you and your organization helps nonprofits get started by talking about what an investment committee should look like and what an investment strategy should look like. If people were interested in chatting more with you and getting more information about what the next steps would be, what is the best way for people to reach out to you? Like your website
They should go to our website, fairlightadvisors.com. And we have loads of blog insights to start you off. We actually have a free resource so you can download that is about a guide to starting your endowment, all the high level things you need to know to get started. We also have a resource on who to hire if you want to hire a professional like us or someone else to manage that. What do you have to do? What is that process and how do you get involved? And we also have resources on what is the role of a finance committee and what is a good, how do you recruit a finance committee as well? And those are all, I would say, good resources to start first. And then talk with your board and your staff to say, are we ready for this? And I'm sure a lot of small organizations were ready, you know, we have $10,000 toward a grant that we want to give for a few years and we want it, you know, maybe not necessarily professionally managed, but at least we want the policies in place to give $1,000 a year, let's say. And this is restricted. We've restricted it. We're a mini foundation, volunteer run. And so we have an investment account.
There you go.
So, you know, it doesn't have to be 10 million, 10,000, 100,000, whatever the organization feels represents the future of what their mission, their goal, their impact.
I love that. Yeah. So it just goes to say, it doesn't really matter how big or how small your organization is, how long you've been around. There are a lot of resources out there for creating an endowment, creating kind of the plan for the future. And certainly check out Maya's website if you need resources just to get the conversation flowing, whether you're a leader of a nonprofit and this has been on your agenda, or if you're a treasurer, it's like, oh yeah, I should probably pay a little bit more attention to that. Definitely check out those resources. I took a peek before our call and they are really, really insightful. So thank you, Maya, for that. And Maya, thank you again for joining us. I know this is a conversation that probably resonates with tons of nonprofits, kind of thinking about what is the plan. And even if they don't have the resources yet, every organization wants to have the resources to create a future plan. So thank you for at least some of these initial baby steps to get us started. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tasha. It was a pleasure.
Great. And for everybody else listening, if you would do me a huge favor and engage with our content in some way, as I say every time, by subscribing, liking, sharing, that allows more nonprofit leaders like yourself to find the content. Thank you all, and we'll see you next time.
That's all we have for you today. Once again, I'm Tasha Anderson with the Charity CFO, and this is A Modern Nonprofit Podcast. Make sure to subscribe to A Modern Nonprofit Podcast on all major streaming platforms so you will stay notified for when the latest episode drops, which will help you stay in the know about anything nonprofit related. Also, join our community on Facebook by searching for A Modern Nonprofit Podcast and follow us on all of our social media accounts. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.